This podcast is, of course, made possible through the support of our members and from Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community with convenient locations throughout northern New England. World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
Support for The Exchange weekly New Hampshire News Roundup is made possible by Eastern Bank. We're here, you're first.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Josh Rogers. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange. Governor Sununu provokes and then makes up with the mayor of Lawrence, Massachusetts, over claims that city is to blame for 85% of the fentanyl flowing into New Hampshire. Spiking numbers of people waiting in hospital emergency rooms, sometimes for days, re-raise the question of New Hampshire's capacity to care for people with mental illness. And the guy responsible for the botched awarding of the Best Picture Oscar, turns out he's from New Hampshire. Those stories and plenty more on New Hampshire's weekly New Hampshire News Roundup this week. I'm Josh Rogers, joined by Trent Spinner, New Hampshire Union leader, Dean Spiliota, Southern New Hampshire University, and Casey McDermott from here at NHPR. Good morning, all. Let's start with Governor Sununu and his spat with the mayor of Lawrence. In remarks at St. Anselm College Wednesday, the governor cited the city as the origin of the bulk of the fentanyl plaguing New Hampshire, and he suggested that New Hampshire will try to act to stop from coming in. On the one hand, the sentiment here is pretty boilerplate, but the way Sununu said it stirred some controversy, didn't it, Trent?
That's right. Let's just remember this was an hour-long meeting with business and industry leaders, and a couple of sentences were really some media outlets really focused on a couple of sentences. The entirety of the speech was about the mental health crisis, was about energy costs, healthcare costs, but part of it, he said that I think it was like 85% of drugs are coming up from Lawrence, from across the border. And the Lawrence mayor was upset and saw that and called it an impromptu press conference yesterday, where the mayor from Lawrence said that Governor Sununu should not be focusing specifically on Lawrence, that's not the focus of that's the drug problem is much bigger than just Lawrence, that there are.
Well, why don't we listen to what the governor did say at St. Anselm? He said he also went on Boston Herald Radio and in toto, that's sort of what made this happen. But why don't we go to the tape?
85% of the fentanyl in this state is coming straight out of Lawrence, Massachusetts. Guess what? We're going in, and we're going to get tough on these guys. And I want to scare every dealer that wants to come across that border. We're not giving dealers 9 months in parole and probation anymore. We're putting them away for the 5, 10, and 15 years that they deserve.
All right. So that was Governor Sununu on Wednesday morning. And then Wednesday afternoon, he went on Boston Herald Radio. And why don't we listen to a clip of that?
There are some sanctuary city issues going on in Massachusetts that have a direct effect on New Hampshire. For example, Lawrence, right? So you have undocumented drug dealers that are dealing these drugs. They're getting arrested. They're being given bail by judges. I can't understand how they're getting bail, by the way, with the judges in Massachusetts. Mm-hmm. They're jumping bail, getting a new ID, and they're back in that same home dealing drugs a week later. It's an absolutely crazy system. So the net negatives of this sanctuary city nonsense are just so detrimental on a community. I think people think it's a nice little political headline or something, but at the end of the day, it has real horrible consequences for some of these communities.
All right, that was Governor Sununu speaking Wednesday afternoon on Boston Herald Radio. You mash these things together, and we have drugs, sanctuary cities, questions of sovereignty, some might see a racial element going on, kind of an alloy of a lot of hot button topics. Dean.
Yeah, it's interesting. The mayor of Lawrence said that the governor needed to choose his words a little more carefully. It's interesting. I think just as there's been criticism of Donald Trump at the national level for not fully recognizing that what he says as president can have a significant impact. This is now the second time we've heard this about Governor Sununu. If you remember back, I think it was during the campaign, he said that busloads of voters were being brought into New Hampshire, just kind of sort of off the cuff made that comment. He's since backed away from that. But I think, this is sort of instructive for him. He's now the chief executive of the state, and people are listening very carefully to what he says. The other thing that interested me was he made news about drug enforcement because my understanding, and I think the attorney general has said this as well, we don't currently go across New Hampshire law enforcement doesn't currently go across borders for drug enforcement. So if they're going to to start doing that, that's going to require negotiations with Massachusetts. But I think the bigger issue is the sort of the governor sort of learning how to kind of calibrate what he says. Now maybe he said this intentionally to kind of stir things up, and maybe that will help make some progress on the issue. But on the other hand, it created an unnecessary furor, just as what we see with Donald Trump sometimes, that took away from the other issues that Trent mentioned. It was just a small part of the speech.
Let's just be clear that drugs are coming up from the Massachusetts border, if you ask any police department anywhere in southern New Hampshire. Yeah. And they currently, if there's a drug investigation that takes them to Lawrence or somewhere else, I mean, in Manchester, there was a gang warfare that there were dozens of shootings. And they tracked that down to gangs in the northern part of Massachusetts. And the Manchester Police Department had detectives in Lawrence and other towns in Massachusetts.
Well, yesterday, Attorney General Foster said that he wouldn't necessarily dispute the numbers that the governor used, that the 85%, you know, isn't implausible to be coming up from Massachusetts. But why don't we hear from Mayor Dan Rivera, the mayor of Lawrence? He apparently reached out to Governor Sununu by phone. They were supposed to talk. Media interest in this prompted him to have a press conference.
I don't know. I don't know if that's a true number. But I know we got an opioid problem. I know we got kids at too young of an age becoming addicts. And I know that we have two kids at too young of an age because they can't find other economic opportunity selling drugs. Not just in my community, by the way. And I think that the problem is that you think like, oh, if we snuff out what's happening in Lawrence, it will all go away. I know he's only been on the job 60 days, but the reality is it's like water. It will find another place to go.
That was Mayor Dan Rivera of Lawrence yesterday. And interestingly, Sununu and Mayor Rivera did chat, and afterwards he issued a statement saying the mayor and his local law enforcement personnel have been doing a good job, but we must recognize this as a cross-border problem that requires cross-border solutions. It has no geographic boundary. It remains incumbent upon us to all work together and collaboratively across our borders with state, federal, and local law enforcement. And on the sort of sovereignty point, if you listen to the totality of Sununu's remarks at St. Anselm, he was talking about how he had been in meetings with, you know, Governor Baker and law enforcement in Massachusetts talking about cooperation. It ought to be noted, though, that Charlie Baker did also criticize Sununu for the remarks he made, Casey.
Yeah, and I think it's interesting just kind of comparing the two characterizations of the call that happened yesterday. Governor Sununu issued a very brief, very kind of exceedingly diplomatic statement after the call, as you suggested. Mayor Rivera, just looking at his Twitter page, someone had posted the comments that he issued afterwards, and his are much more detailed in terms of, he said that, you know, he reiterated kind of three main concerns to Sununu, that it's not possible to arrest their way out of the problem, that no one jurisdiction can deal with this alone, and thirdly, that the statement says that he should be more thoughtful and measured with his statements and understand that they have serious implications. So it is interesting just to see, you know, this is a case, I think, as Dean suggested, where Sununu is now the chief executive of the state. He speaks for New Hampshire and his words have a lot of power. And I think that this is a case where it illustrated that, you know, even if you're just saying it, you know, on a radio station or somewhere where you might not necessarily be in front of an audience of business executives, that can, you know, have an impact in very real ways.
Well, certainly the context of both this comment, the one to Boston Herald Radio, and comments he made on the Howie Carr show, it does seem that he has shown it's becoming something of a pattern. He goes on a kind of conservative radio venue and, you know, gets a little bit more out there than he does, you know, when he was speaking at St. Anselm or, you know, in New Hampshire. And you know, what that means going forward, I guess we'll find out. But I do think it's fair to say that you know, this is something that, I mean, it's hard to see this hurting him in New Hampshire politically. I mean, if you're going to look at it,
I mean, Massachusetts has always been used as a scapegoat in one way or another for the state's problems. Like, this is nothing new. And as Trent said, as you said, citing the attorney general, it's not necessarily inaccurate to say that a lot of the drugs are coming from Massachusetts. I think the issue is that, you know, throwing out these numbers without citations or kind of making what sound like very sweeping statements about the way that the state's justice system is handling undocumented citizens and kind of putting them back out there. That in totality, I think, raised a lot of red flags.
Or suggesting Trent's point about the detectives is well taken. But, you know, if you listen to his words in the speech, it sounds like we're going to start sending you know, we're going to take the matters into New Hampshire's going to take the matters into its own hands and start sending law enforcement over the border into Lawrence to clean this up. And that's just not the reality.
Right.
Tell us what you think. The exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org or at NHPR Exchange on Facebook and Twitter. Again, this week we have Casey McDermott of here at NHPR, Trent Spinner, New Hampshire Union Leader, Dean Spiliotis, Southern New Hampshire University. You know, let's drop this and see what seems to be the impetus for the comments in the first place, which was Sununu's meetings with governors and President Trump at the National Governors Association in D.C. last week. And he met as well as with President Trump, with Governors LePage, Governor Scott of Vermont, Governor Baker of Massachusetts. And one big topic that came up was certainly the repeal of Obamacare, including changes and possibly big ones to Medicaid. Lots of talk of block grants. The governor says states are likely to get several options to choose from when it comes to the future of Medicaid. All will give the states more flexibility, he says, and carry some degree of risk. I tried to push him on this a little bit earlier this week to tip his hand. He really didn't. He said the public will learn soon in a matter of weeks. So I guess we'll see there. But one thing that was interesting is that no one's really had to push the governor these days on his support for President Trump. When he was tapping trees at the ceremonial tree tapping, he was talking to a maple producer and said this about the president and his meetings with him.
He wants to know what the governors want because we're the ones that have to implement whatever's going to work. And he, you know, he'd say, you know, we'd have a question. He'd look right to the secretaries and say, okay, what are we doing here? How do we answer this question? How do we get these guys the information they need to make decisions? And it isn't what are we going to do in 6 months. It's what are we doing this week? How do we get them an answer by Monday or Tuesday? It was like there was real meat to these discussions. I was very impressed with him as a manager. It was great.
All right. That was Governor Sununu on Wednesday, post tapping a maple, talking to a maple producer about his meeting with President Trump. You know, what do you make of that, Dean? I mean, that is a pretty foursquare, you know, sort of viva Trump.
Yeah, that's one way of putting it. You know, I think part of this is he's a new governor. This was his first time participating in the National Governors Association meeting. I got to meet a lot of other very high-powered governors, Republican governors. There are a lot of them around the country. You know, meeting with the president is always a big deal. I don't think there's anything to be gained by him coming back to New Hampshire and saying he was somehow disappointed in the response. You know, the reality with all of this is we will see what happens down the road. You know, will things start to change dramatically in a fairly short order? I mean, that was not to get off topic, but that was my sort of general criticism of Trump's Tuesday night speech in general, was it still we're still sort of in the promissory phase about how things are going to change, and perhaps they will, and then he would likely get reelected, but we don't know yet. So I sort of understand where, given my knowledge of how these meetings work with the governors, I understand Governor Sununu's enthusiasm, and I'm sure it was genuine, but a lot of what he just said in that clip is really kind of, you know, based on the idea that things will change in fairly short
order. Well,
certainly
if you're hoping to achieve some sort of flexibility, be it in Medicaid, be it in education, it certainly doesn't hurt to you know, be optimistic
about
what the
president's going to do. And he's been fairly warm to Trump for a while now.
Sure.
I mean, even if you look at the initial reaction to the immigration ban that was issued about a month ago, I think it's fair to say that Sununu was, even among his Republican colleagues, among the more supportive, or at least not outwardly, you know, kind of pushing back on that as much as the Charlie Bakers of the world or other kind of neighboring Republican governors. So I think that, you know, we're seeing definitely, you know, a more enthusiastic Chris Sununu when it comes to how President Trump is handling things. I think it's interesting to note that during the joint session earlier this week, he had kind of a number of tweets that he was sending out highlighting, you know, POTUS is delivering a strong message on working to boost our economy. You know, POTUS is right. Let the states decide what's best for them when it comes to Medicaid, standing up for school choice, just, you know, doing a lot of kind of cheerleading from the sidelines there. So, you know, I think like Dean said, it'll be interesting to see whether New Hampshire and Governor Sununu gets anything in return for that support.
Well, obviously the response from Democrats, and obviously we have an all-Democratic delegation, was, you know, kind of predictably skeptical to somewhat hostile towards the president's address. But it was interesting to hear what Jeanne Shaheen said about some of the items that she might hope Democrats could work with the president on.
Most of us would agree that we need to invest in our infrastructure, rebuild our roads and bridges, our water systems, our wastewater treatment systems, our broadband. He also talked about lowering the cost of prescription drugs, something that I think is very important and I've been working on since I was governor. He talked about the importance of child care and paid family leave, both things that I think are very important to working people in New Hampshire and across the country. And he talked about combating the opioid epidemic, something that he promised when he was in New Hampshire, and something that I'm certainly committed to and there's bipartisan support to address.
All right. That was Senator Jeanne Shaheen responding to Trump's speech. Trent, anything there you find anything other than utterly, you know, predictable? Like, let's accentuate the things on which we could possibly agree.
Something I thought was interesting, and I don't know if she said that in your interview or if it was just part of her statement, but she went on when she was talking about substance misuse, and she was, you know, Trump talked about that during the speech, but she's very concerned about what the actual budget will look like, specifically for New Hampshire. We didn't get as much money as we thought, even from the Obama administration. It was millions of dollars instead of, you know, what some people hope would be tens of millions or even hundreds of millions of dollars to combat heroin here. And so I think that's going to be a really interesting thing to watch is what happens. And it's great. Everyone wants to talk about it. But what kind of money are we actually getting? What kind of support are we getting to fix the problem?
Well, I think the 21st Century Cures Act is what you're talking about. I think my understanding is that New Hampshire was supposed to get $10 million under the formula, and now that's being rejiggered to
six. It's about six.
And,
it's a $6 million.
You know, that's going to have an effect on state budget riders, which we'll get to in a bit. Why don't we take a listen to what Senator Hassan had to say after the speech? She had a little bit slightly more edgy tone. This is an interview she did with NH1.
Well, I thought his speech was at complete odds with reality. When you listen to the words he said last night and compare them to the policies that he and his administration have been pursuing and that he actually doubled down on in the speech, they really are at complete odds. So we have a president who has been pursuing policies that help the wealthy at the expense of the middle class, who wants to repeal the Affordable Care Act and Medicaid expansion.
That was Senator Hassan responding to Trump's joint address, President Trump's joint address earlier this week. You know, sort of a more elbows out approach, Dean.
Yeah, Senator Hassan is right in one respect. I think there's a tremendous degree of consistency in the core economic and security related proposals that President Trump laid out in that speech Tuesday night. One of the cable channels did a fascinating side by side comparison of his address to a joint session of Congress with his CPAC, the conservative activist group, about a week earlier or a few days earlier or something like that. And the tones were completely different. The one Tuesday night was sort of very measured and presidential. The one at CPAC was very sort of aggressive and sarcastic and sort of vintage Trump slamming the media and Democrats. But the actual policy content on things like healthcare, immigration, and the economy were virtually identical. So he has been very consistent. You know, real quickly on Senator Shaheen, the two areas that Democrats always mention, infrastructure and healthcare, there are massive differences, not only between Democrats and Republicans, but in transportation, infrastructure, for example, big differences between Republicans as well. So I think in theory they might work together, but that's going to be a tough slog.
All right. More on this speech after the break on this weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange in just a moment. And NHPR, do join us. The number is 1-800-892-6477 and email at exchange@nhpr.org or at NHPR Exchange on Facebook and Twitter. Stick around.
Poet Eva Kruschill writes in her most recent collection about the history of American immigration.
And I think it's funny that history repeats itself, and that as soon as we get legalized, we tend to distance ourselves from those people who are not legalized yet, but they have something to tell us.
This week on The Bookshelf from NHPR, Eva Kruschill on poetry and immigration. Subscribe to The Bookshelf from NHPR wherever you get your podcasts.
This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange. I'm Josh Rogers. The exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. Email at exchange@nhpr.org, or do find us on Twitter and Facebook at NHPR Exchange. Joined this week by Dean Spiliotis, Southern New Hampshire University, Casey McDermott, NHPR, and Trent Spinner, New Hampshire union leader. We do have a few emails. This is from Mark in Canaan. He says, though I'm not a supporter of Governor Sununu, he did get this one right on the head. This is talking about Lawrence. The border area from Lowell to Lawrence to Haverhill has for decades had issues of crime, violence, and drugs. That's why I left the area 35 years ago, but haven't regretted it a day. That's from Mark in Canaan. And this certainly the trope, and you know, there's some basis in reality about drugs coming from Lowell and Lawrence. I mean, certainly, you know, growing up in New Hampshire, it was always like, oh, Lawrence and Lowell, that's where the drugs come from, that's where the gangs are from. And, you know, that's something that obviously people in Lawrence and Lowell don't like to hear, but it's something that politicians in New Hampshire have long been quite comfortable saying.
I would say the Attorney General for the state of New Hampshire confirms it, says that the, quote, the majority of drugs of heroin and fentanyl come from Lawrence. So,
I mean, I guess it depends what you mean by comes from Lawrence, but, you know, certainly, you know, he did say that Sununu wasn't wrong, and that's where most of the, you know, it's coming up from 93,
right.
95, basically.
Right.
We have another email on this, and this is from Marjorie. Mr. Trump campaigned across the country using New Hampshire and its opioid crisis as a poster boy. What is the result? Instead of the 10 million we expected for opioid response, we are only getting 6 million. That's from Marjorie in Durham. You know, I'm not sure exactly, and, you know, we're all going to be doing more reporting on the formula and how this was calibrated. Casey, do you have a sense of what change took place?
According to a story from the Concord Monitor earlier this week, it has something to do with no longer looking at it in terms of per capita drug deaths, but instead looking kind of, I think, purely numerically and in terms of population, and obviously New Hampshire, compared to other larger states like California, Texas, Florida, loses out when you look at sheer numbers.
So places like New Hampshire and West Virginia, which
yeah,
I believe has the
yeah.
highest per capita.
Yeah, and the Concord Monitor goes into more detail on this, but New Hampshire has, I believe, the second highest per capita drug deaths in the nation next to West Virginia. So if you were looking at it in that context, it stands to reason that New Hampshire would get more money, and I think that was what a lot of people were expecting here.
But I mean, this change, do we know whether this was a change that took place in a statute, through rules, through some sort of discretion of
it was an agency decision.
Yeah.
So the House and Senate came together, they passed money, they appropriated the money, and then agencies under the Obama administration
right.
decided how to dole that out. And that's what caught our delegation off guard, was they thought that there would be a certain amount of money. And once the federal agency went through the process of doling out that money, it was different. And that's just one bill. That's just this 21st Century Cures Act. There are a number of other bills that appropriated money. And don't forget, during the campaign, we heard people saying that there would be hundreds of millions of dollars coming. That money has not showed up.
And, you know, to Marjorie's point, President Trump, when he campaigned, did make a big deal about how he found New Hampshire's drug problem so dissonant with the natural beauty of the state, and that he was going to stop the drugs from coming in, and that he was going to address this, you know, a tough problem. The proof will be in the pudding at the state and federal level. But thank you for the emails. Why don't we stick with our congressional delegation for a moment out of the speech? I thought it was interesting the guests that they chose to bring to the speech from Senator Shaheen. We had someone who works at Planned Parenthood. From Senator Hassan, we had a local woman who received treatment under Obamacare. From Carol Shea Porter, we had the head of the union at the Naval Shipyard. And from Custer, we saw the mother of somebody who died of an overdose. You know, given, you know, what happened with this Cures Act money, given the makeup of our delegation, obviously New Hampshire was the place that, you know, allegedly got Trump going. I mean, it was the first state he won. Any sense of whether there's, I mean, how effective, you know, our delegation could be in getting money? I mean, it seems tough given the politics.
It seems very tough given the politics. And that's something that we're watching, certainly, is how do four Democrats from New Hampshire in an off cycle, in a non-primary year, how do they leverage their political power to get New Hampshire what, you know, a lot of people in the addiction and recovery world say that they need to combat this problem? It's going to be a tough hill to climb.
And certainly Republicans have been latching onto a comment that Senator Shaheen made describing Russian hacking, you know, as an act of war. That's something that really seems to have received legs in the conservative media nationally. You know, the local Republican Party has called people's attention to it as well. You know, we've talked about how Senator Shaheen is sort of, you know, increasingly kind of leaning out there a bit within the Democratic delegation. And, you know, we'll see where this Jeff Sessions thing goes. But, you know, is it right to consider those sort of fighting words, or is that just a statement of you know, a realistic take on Russian hacking?
Well, you know, I certainly it's a way to underscore the importance of the issue. I mean, that's been one of the big debates between Republicans and Democrats over sort of how significant the issue was, the extent to which it did or did not have an impact on the outcome of the election. It's been an important argument made by a lot of Democrats. We should note that that Senator John McCain also used the act of war analogy or comment a while back on the same issue. So, you know, I think there's going to be debate about, you know, whether or not that's too hyperbolic or whether it underscores how important the issue is. But that comment I view as sort of part and parcel of the larger debate between Republicans and Democrats over how deeply to look into the hacking issue and figuring out to what extent it was or was not impactful on the election. And then there is, you know, as we know, it may very well get rolled in to some extent into the whole Sessions recusal that's just happened over the last 2 days.
Casey. And my understanding, too, just looking at some reporting on this, it doesn't seem to me, at least looking at the stories that I've seen, that she outright said this was an act of war, we need to act. The comments that she made during a committee hearing were, we should think about whether this is an act of war or not. So it was, you know, raising the question for people to consider and not necessarily saying,
issue.
Well, you know, as the scrutiny of Jeff Sessions continues in his recusal, you know, there are confirmation hearings. Democrats are, you know, Republicans say Democrats are kind of slow walking these things, like, you know, that's probably inevitable. Ben Carson was voted in as HUD secretary. Senator Shaheen and Hassan both voted against, saying Carson's not qualified. An interesting sort of footnote to that is that, you know, Senator Hassan's father, Robert Wood, was essentially instrumental in the design of HUD as a member of the Johnson administration and briefly served as HUD secretary. You know, there are questions, though, about whether or not, you know, the Trump cabinet and the lower appointments are getting in there quick enough to actually effectively manage government.
That was one interesting thing that I don't think a lot of people picked up in during the Jeff Sessions press conference yesterday, where he basically said, I'm here with a bare bones team and I wish I had people. And I think that this happens at the beginning of every administration. And so I think it would take some more reporting to see exactly how many people are still left. But I think it's hundreds of people who have not been approved by the Senate. And I think that makes running government difficult.
One thing that Senator Shaheen and Hassan said a week ago that's also got them some attention, mainly of the partisan variety from Republicans, was during the town hall they had a week ago, you know, more or less as we speak in Concord, which was that they, you know, would be supportive of making sure that in future presidential elections the person who got the popular vote would win. And, you know, you can understand how that might go over big in a room full of Democrats in this environment. You know, Dean, you're the political scientist here. Like, that change would take a lot of work to make happen.
Not likely to occur. You know, this is one of those things that we hear about when you have the kind of outcome that we had. We heard similar comments back in 2000. You know, there really is no kind of political environment to make that change right now, given how much control Republicans have both at the national and state level. It's just not really an environment in which something like that would go forward. And the reality is, you know, there's a lot of sort of social science writing about all the different ways in which you might elect a president and the different schemes of electing a president. And there are always all kinds of unintended consequences. And I just think this is this system that we have, the Electoral College, which goes all the way back to the founding of the Constitution. I just think it's embedded in the Constitution. It'd be incredibly difficult to change the Constitution, and it's certainly not going to happen given the realities of Republican control nationally and locally at this point.
And remember this, all those New Hampshire voters who are saying, let's get rid of the Electoral College. Did you like seeing Hillary Clinton before the election? Did you like seeing Donald Trump before the election? If the Electoral College goes away, why would a candidate come to New Hampshire and do a campaign rally in front of 10,000 people when they could do something in front of 100,000 people? Why would they come to a state with we have 4 Electoral College votes now, which actually gives us some clout in the election. If it was just a matter of getting the million voters, or it's not even a million people vote here, 750,000 people vote here, that probably wouldn't be enough to get a national candidate.
Well, and that was Donald Trump's argument. He, in response to the Hillary Clinton winning the popular vote, Trump's argument was, well, you know, if we had done this based on popular vote, my campaign strategy would have been completely different, which is what you're suggesting, that he probably would not have come to New Hampshire.
Right.
Tell us what you think. The number is 1-800-892-6477. Email at exchange@nhpr.org or at NHPR Exchange on Facebook and Twitter. I want to stick with a political story of a national sort, but with certainly local implications. It resolved itself over the weekend, and that's the election of Tom Perez as DNC chairman. This was a post sought by Raymond Buckley, the longtime chair of New Hampshire's Democratic Party. When he learned that that wasn't in the cards, he threw his support to Keith Ellison, who was seen as Perez's main rival, Minnesota congressman, and had been promised a leading role nationally should Ellison have won. He didn't. Casey, you were at Ray Buckley's press conference to sort of talk about the fallout from goings on at the DNC meeting. You know, we do know, barring an act of God, Ray Buckley will be returning as New Hampshire's Democratic chairman. What more do we know about the implications for New Hampshire out of the Perez win?
It's unclear right now, and Buckley didn't have a lot of details in terms of what his role might be in the new DNC under the Perez era. He did sound, I think, more optimistic than I was expecting him to, just given that, you know, he threw his hat into the ring and was unsuccessful, bowed out after he didn't get as much, you know, traction as kind of Tom Perez and Keith Ellison, and threw his support behind Keith Ellison. My understanding, based on reporting that was out there, was that he had been offered kind of a prime spot in the new DNC, chiefly in charge of kind of reorganizing, reimagining, rebuilding the state party grassroots system, which is something that he was pretty passionate about, yeah, in his candidacy, and continues to be very outspoken on in the aftermath of the DNC election. So one of the things that Buckley did say when he sat down with a few members of the New Hampshire Press Corps was that he does think that Tom Perez will have I think his phrase was a radically different relationship with state parties than, he didn't say Debbie Wasserman Schultz, but the implied was the Debbie Wasserman Schultz era of the DNC, and said that, you know, there were a number of ways in which that relationship was kind of fractured. State parties were not given the kind of attention and investments that he thought that they needed to. He outright said that Hillary Clinton lost the election and Democrats lost in November because the DNC failed to invest adequately in state parties, which I thought was a pretty strong statement.
I mean, it's
statement.
Sort of easy to say now.
Yeah, obviously, right, but, exactly. I mean, hindsight is 2020. But so he sounded optimistic. And also said that, you know, he wasn't quite sure, like I said, what he was going to be doing, but, you know, was looking forward to working with Perez.
Even you know, President Trump has been a big galvanizing tool for Democrats. Obviously, there are fissures in the party, and obviously you could, you know, potentially oversimplify this Perez-Ellison race as between, you know, kind of an Obama wing of the party, if you want to call it a wing, meaning Perez, former Secretary of Labor, and more sort of insurgent Sanders Warren wing with Ellison. You know, one thing all those wings share is a real dislike for President Trump. And, you know, it's often easier for parties organizationally when they're not winning, in some degree, when they're really motivated, you know, to defeat an incumbent.
Right. But then how do they do that? And that's where the different that's where we see the Democratic Party kind of splitting. A couple of other things to note, even though Chairman Buckley didn't win the election, I think one point that was really important that he did come away with as a win was that no one's talking about changing the New Hampshire primary, and no one's talking about changing the calendar. There's still time, obviously, but that's an important part of what happened here.
And he, at the press conference earlier this week, says that he has no reason to believe at this point that either of those things are in jeopardy.
Now, a couple of things to watch will be whether New Hampshire gets its second debate back in the, you know, in 2008 and previous cycles. There were two debates. There was an early summer debate with Democratic candidates nationally televised, and then there was one between Iowa and New Hampshire. If you remember back to the most recent cycle here, there was only one debate scheduled, the reindeer debate, as people called it. It was the Saturday before Christmas. Not many people watched if you looked at the numbers. And some people allege that Debbie Wasserman Schultz and the DNC scheduled it at that time so that Bernie Sanders couldn't get as much attention as Bernie Sanders wanted. There was eventually a second debate, but it came after a lot of fighting, and Buckley was part of that. So we'll be
well, the same one on the Republican side, as you well know.
Yeah, I know very well after getting kicked out of it.
Yeah.
So it'll be interesting to see what Ray is able to do in terms of getting New Hampshire that second debate back and making sure that the New Hampshire primary calendar stays locked in. Yeah,
the broader underlying context for the DNC is, and this is something that Republicans have hammered on for a while now, is pretty significant losses in state control over the last 8 years with President Obama. You know, there's a research in political science that talks about the ways in which what happens with the president at the national level is increasingly kind of detached from what goes on at the state and local level. So Democrats have a lot of work to do, particularly in the Midwest, where President Trump took some states that were believed to be part of the so-called blue wall. That's going to be the challenge. And it's interesting, you know, we've seen Howard Dean popping up on cable TV a lot recently because he was DNC chair at a time when Democrats made significant gains and he had this so-called 50-state strategy. I think there's going to be some return to that and really trying to get back to the grassroots in a number of these states.
For the record, I mean, Dean did pop up early as a potential candidate and then later
and then
through his support. And I'm going to defer to Casey on how to pronounce this fellow's name, but
Buttigieg.
Yes, Pete Buttigieg. Yeah. The was it the mayor of
South Bend, Indiana.
Howard Dean supported him in the race for DNC chair.
Worth noting too that Buckley at the press conference earlier this week specifically said that he thinks that, you know, he envisions a DNC returning to that 50-state strategy. Now I think they call it a 57-state strategy because of the territories and other entities. But it is fair to say that that's kind of the path that at least, you know, Buckley is projecting for the DNC right now.
And the State Democratic Committee, they're sort of refreshing their kind of cadre of underlings for Chairman Buckley. But they aren't resting too much at the moment. They did file a complaint against Manchester Mayor Ted Gatzis on a campaign finance matter. What's at issue there, Trent?
Someone else might have to jump in here. But basically, what the Democrats are alleging is that he used general election money during the primary campaign. I think we're talking about several hundreds of thousands of dollars in terms of money that he raised. And they're saying that some of that, I think about $66,000, should not have been spent before he lost in the primary.
And they figured that out by looking at how much he raised and how much he spent overall. And they said, well, there's this certain smaller amount that should not have been spent. And candidates can, in theory, donate to charity or carry it over to a general election. So that's basically the essence of the complaint.
I thought it was interesting to see the response from the Attorney General's office, which was kind of like, oh, yeah, we'll get to that.
They've got a lot of stuff on their plate in terms of election-related investigations, and I guess we'll see where that goes. And do see where this show goes by sticking around. We'll be back after a short break. More Grand State headlines on Exchange Weekly New Hampshire News Roundup.
The Poet Eva Kruschill writes in her most recent collection about the history of American immigration.
And I think it's funny that history repeats itself, and that as soon as we get legalized, we tend to distance ourselves from those people who are not legalized yet, but they have something to tell us.
This week on The Bookshelf from NHPR, Eva Kruschill on poetry and immigration. Subscribe to The Bookshelf from NHPR wherever you get your podcasts.
This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange. I'm Josh Rogers. As always, join us. The number is 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org, or you can actually watch us on Facebook Live. Joined this week by Trent Spinner, New Hampshire Union Leader, Casey McDermott, NHPR Dean Spiliotis, Southern New Hampshire University. Want to go to an email. This is from David. He says, a pure popular vote means the most populated states, California, New York, Texas, Illinois, et cetera, would dominate elections, where in the current state, smaller states, including New Hampshire, wield a disproportionate influence. But I'm very much okay with that because it ensures a more widespread electorate. Not a common argument you hear in New Hampshire, at least among people who like to go to campaign events during presidential season. Another email, this is from Fred in Canterbury. He said, no one has mentioned the demand side. Oh, this is on drugs. What kind of society can we build in which people will be wholly engaged in life without being tempted to use deadly drugs? And, you know, this was actually a point that was raised in a way by the mayor of Lawrence. He said, you know, we can talk about it's bad we have a society where we have people who grow up wanting to take drugs and people grow up wanting to sell drugs, that, you know, it's a problem that is complicated, and that's certainly something that, you know, on the demand side, Governor Sununu has talked about increasing drug education in schools to try to curb that demand. You know, the State House has been quiet this week. The Senate's on vacation, a light schedule in the House, but there has been some action on the budget that is of note. The Ways and Means Committee has released revenue projections that peg collections down over what Governor Sununu predicted, $59 million. They chalk up that difference to what they say is Sununu's inclusion of one-time money, which is something that, you know, Governor Sununu has said repeatedly that he has not done, and some differences in tax projections. We've already touched on the shorting of New Hampshire over what had been estimated in the 20th Century Cures Act. You know, it's the time of year when the House really starts to focus on the budget. There's kind of push and pull over revenue. But, you know, this may seem to suggest that we may not have all the money sitting around that Governor Sununu was hoping for, Casey.
Yeah, I mean, and I've only been around for, you know, one other budget cycle in New Hampshire. But from what I can recall, the House usually is the place where there's a little bit more of a kind of a pessimistic or a reeling in of the governor's expectations that we see. We heard a pretty sunny projection from Governor Sununu when he unveiled his budget proposal earlier, and, you know, seemed to say, you know, we have the resources to do what we need. He unveiled a number of things, you know, for funding full-day kindergarten, for infrastructure projects, things like that. Now we have the House budget chairman saying we're going to have to cut programs potentially, we're going to have to reel stuff in. But I think it's important to keep in mind that, you know, the budget process, there's always this kind of ebbing and flowing of expectations.
It tends to constrict at this time of year and then often kind of stretch out a little bit
exactly.
when it gets to the Senate.
The Senate seems to be the place where you get a more of a realistic sense of what the budget is actually going to look like. I remember a few years ago when the House got a hold of the budget, there was all of this talk of cutting, you know, a ton of health programs, services for people with disabilities, other, you know, kind of social services that the state provided. But there was a lot of outcry. By the time it got to the Senate, a lot of that stuff was restored. So I would expect that something similar might play out this time.
All right. And let's go to the phones. On the phone, we have Jeff of Whitefield. I believe this is Senator Woodburn, minority leader in the state Senate. Good morning, Senator.
The more you talk, the more different topics come up that one certainly want to comment on. But, you know, I think that the comment on the Democratic Party and where we are going, I think it's important that not only you have a strategy for every state, but really appealing like we used to do in the old days to every voter, a message that works everywhere, you know, in rural areas in particular. You know, I ran 18 points ahead of Hillary Clinton, and I think if we stay focused on a populist, progressive, and plain-spoken message, we can appeal to everyone. And I think that's a focal point of a new strategy for Democrats. And in contrasting that, I think, you know, serving on the committee that studies the our election laws is this whole attack by Trump and, you know, some Republicans, but, you know, to the credit, most Republicans, you know, are not buying the fraud in New Hampshire. But I think that is clearly an attack on the integrity of the New Hampshire primary and sets him up to not participate or possibly even lose our New Hampshire primary because we are a place that, you know, does upend incumbents, presidents, front runners.
So, Senator,
know, place that, yes.
So you mentioned challenges to the electoral system. Obviously, there's going to be Republicans have been focused on trying to do things to, in their words, tighten up New Hampshire's election laws. Are there any changes that would, to use their term, tighten current standards that Democrats could get behind?
You know, we're open to any idea. I mean, the real focal point in areas that we would like to look at is areas of double voting. We have had a very few occurrences of that. And those are things where people, with full knowledge, do something that is intended to get more votes than they're rightfully deserved. That is the problem we should be looking at. But by and large, you know, we have a great New Hampshire system. It works well. It's done on the local level. I've been a town moderator in my little town of Dalton. And, you know, we do elections great in New Hampshire. We should try to make it more participatory. But clearly these are designed, the national template, to make it harder for people to vote and disenfranchise people who are more likely to not vote their way. I mean, I'm a school teacher. I know the kids who don't live in homes. I mean, you know, don't own their homes. And you know, this population is one that really needs to have a government voice. They need to be participating in our democracy.
All right. Thank you, Senator. See you around. Why don't we go to the phones? Len is on the line from Len is not on the line. Okay. Well, so, you know, Senator Woodburn says Democrats are open for any ideas. Casey, you've been covering the push and pull on election laws very closely. Are you seeing any Democratic openness to anything that would meaningfully change?
It's tough to get anyone to say so outwardly. I think we're going to see more once these ideas actually come to the floor. So far, it's been mostly in committee hearings, and there's very little, if any, reception to the idea of changing, you know, for example, the residency definite, like what counts as a residency for voting purposes, the idea of enacting any kind of a residency requirement in the form of, you know, you have to live in the state 30 days before casting a vote. And there's been a lot of concern, at least from what I've observed, you know, online or just kind of following the conversation that's been playing out about, at least from Democrats, about a bill that is expected to be introduced next week, SB3 out of the Senate, that is being described as kind of the main vehicle for all of the changes that Republicans are hoping to enact. I think I'm actually talking to the sponsor of the bill later today and expecting to get some more details, because it's my understanding that what's out there right now is going to change before it gets to.
Yeah. I mean, it certainly ought to be said that you know, what Democrats want on election laws is simply not going to happen,
right,
given
right.
the makeup of the legislature.
A lot of what they're proposing is, you know, more making it easier for more people to register to vote. Republicans, I think, you know, this is a generalization, but see that as the potential for more fraud and abuse if you open up that process too much.
And just real quick on Senator Woodburn's other comments about the nature of the Democratic message going forward, you know, I think for a lot of people, that was part of the underlying debate over the choice of the next DNC chair. You know, some people were concerned Congressman Ellison would not focus sufficiently on the areas, the sort of white working class areas that undercut Hillary Clinton in the Midwest. You know, I think this is probably an oversimplification. My guess is either person, Perez or Ellison, will account for that. But that was part of the underlying debate in this decision about who to make the next chair.
All right. Why don't we go to the phones? Andrew is on the line from Keene. Okay, we're having a problem with the phones. Let's skip the phones.
Let me just go back to Senator Woodburn for a second here. My one question is, and I think when you talk to Republicans, here's a case that always comes up, that during the primary, two campaign workers for Senator Bernie Sanders used their office address as their resident, as their domicile, and a lot of Democrats and Republicans who talk to us kind of say, you know, that's not right. And I think that's one of the big focuses that Republicans are looking at is should something like that be legal? were those Sanders campaign workers living at the office? I don't think so. Is that their domicile? They weren't from New Hampshire, but they used that address. And so I think that's one of the things that Republicans are really concerned about. And so that would be something I'd be interested to hear from Senator Woodburn about. And I'm sure I will now that I asked. But does he think that that is okay or that should be allowed? And how do you deal with something like that?
I mean, it does get into the debate over the law and, you know, what people often refer to as the spirit of the law. I mean, a lot of the things that have been claimed, you know, by people from President Trump to Governor Sununu to other people as sort of tantamount to being illegal, you know, are permitted under New Hampshire's law. And this has, you know, been a push and pull that has been going on. And maybe with this bill that, you know, Casey's going to learn about later, we will get some sort of clarity on, like, what direction the state is going. But it would be shocking. And I've talked to Republicans who are big on the election reform front, and some of them have expressed some frustration that maybe things aren't going as quickly as they hoped at the beginning of the session. You know, we got plenty of time till the next election. I know that Republican leaders want to make sure they do something that, you know, is durable, and that's a concern.
Well, it's interesting, too, that, you know, the sponsor of a number of the election law reform bills that we saw coming out of the House, Representative David Bates, he filed, I think, a dozen of the kind of four dozen that we are seeing this session. A number of those have been voted either inexpedient to legislate or retained or otherwise kind of not given the green light by the Election Law Committee. And my understanding is that that was done with the understanding that the House was going to eventually get this kind of catch-all bill from the Senate. So it'll be interesting to see whether that ends up playing out for them. That approach to kind of pack it all into one bill as opposed to filing a lot of little bills, which was the other approach taken by Bates initially.
So we're going to keep – we're obviously going to be paying attention to these issues. It has been a slow week at the state house level due to the school vacation. So I want to turn to some stories that are also of note that aren't political. And one was the developments in the case involving the murder of Selena Cass. The judge on Monday dismissed charges against a man accused of drowning his 11-year-old stepdaughter after finding him incompetent to stand trial. Trent, this is something your paper's obviously covered a great deal.
We've covered this for 5.5 years. It is a heartbreaking story. And on Monday, we found out some details that make it just even more tragic. Wendell Noyes was the stepfather of a young girl, Selena Cass, who lived in West Stewartstown. She went missing back in 2011, and there was a massive search for her. The FBI was called in. National news networks were there trying to get her photo out, and they unfortunately found her dead in a river. We found out new details on Monday. Besides the fact that Wendell Noyes, you know, the charges were dismissed against him, I think everyone saw that headline. But going beyond the headline, some of the things that we found out was that the head FBI agent, the head of the regional FBI, sat in Wendell Noyes' truck and drove with him around the river, this little portion of the river where she was eventually found. And the head FBI agent says, "No, Wendell, I want you to show me where we should be looking for Selena. Show me where we should be looking." And he says, after that short little circle, "I already showed you." Another interesting thing that we never knew because it was in a sealed affidavit was Wendell Noyes was in an interview with state police investigators, storms out of the interview, and they actually – two state police officers follow him from a ways back, and they watch him go to a little bridge overlooking the river, and he starts pointing at the spot in the river where Selena Cass would be found several days later and starts just shouting at the river. And they're watching this through some binoculars. I mean, there are all kinds of details. There were 30 pages that we didn't –
I mean, the decision by the judge to dismiss based on – you know, the belief that that the competence of this man would never improve is an interesting one. And NHPR spoke with UNH law professor Buzz Scherr about this. Why don't we listen to that?
You know, the real interesting thing about this case is that by the public reports, it seems pretty clear that he's never going to become competent to stand trial, which suggests his limitations are not related solely to a severe mental illness manageable through medication. My guess is they are long-term permanent intellectual disabilities and are never going to change. So the suggestion in this case is that's what's going on.
And so, you know, my understanding is that determinations such as this are pretty rare. And, you know, in any of the stuff that your paper has learned recently, I mean, is that reflected in these documents.
Absolutely. The prosecution wants to prosecute this case, right? They don't want him. They don't want the charges to be dismissed. I'll tell you this. I spoke to Wendell Noyes July 26, 2011, and it's a conversation I will never forget. Selena Cass went missing sometime that morning, and one of her friends called the newsroom, and I said, is there an adult in the room that I can speak to about this? They were trying to get some publicity, some coverage to get her photo out, and she passed the phone to Wendell Noyes, and I will never forget that conversation because it's an unfortunate part of the job where you talk to people sometimes in their worst hour, and he was – I don't know how to describe it, but it was a surreal phone call. And now 5.5 years later, understanding everything that was happening there and seeing this decision, I guess what I'm trying to say is it's not surprising.
All right. We're almost to the end of the show. And, this has been school vacation week. It's an easy drive into the station. There's not many cars on the road. There has been less activity over at the State House. Not so next week when people come back. Some of them will be tan, rested, and possibly ready. Casey, what are you going to be focusing on next week?
Probably more of the election law stuff. There's a number of bills that I believe are up for a vote in the House next week, and we'll also get a first look officially at what that kind of catch-all election law reform that is being proposed in the Senate might look like.
Trent?
We're looking forward to town meeting season in New Hampshire. There are going to be dozens, if not hundreds, of town meetings happening across the state. We're going to be covering a whole lot of them. And coming up in the Sunday news, we'll have a preview of some of the big issues.
All right. Always good to know that. Dean?
Like Casey, focused on the state legislature ramping back up after vacation. And I continue to watch very closely the actions of our congressional delegation down in Washington in the midst of all of the turmoil surrounding Russia and other issues.
All right. And before we go, we just have just a minute. I know we've neglected. We talked about in the promo that the man who screwed up with the envelope at Academy Awards is from New Hampshire. Trent, your paper did a nice article about this quickly.
He's from New Hampshire. He's from North Conway. John Rist was his central figure for forever.
He apparently held a state record in the javelin.
Yes,
as well.
He was a Star Trek person, and it's unfortunate to see something like this happening to any New Hampshire person. I think it was just a pure mix-up.
All right, well put, Trent. It's unfortunate to see something like that happen to any New Hampshire person. Thank you for joining us on the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup. I'm Josh Rogers, joined by Casey McDermott, Dean Spiliotis, Trent Spinner. Have a nice weekend, everybody.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. Hey, if you like what you heard, spread the word. Please give us a review on iTunes to help other listeners find us. And thanks.